Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Salim Ismail podcast. Today we have with us Vinay Gupta for part three of a mini-series, is what it's turning out to be. This is somewhat of a prequel. What we're going to do today is talk about some of the work that Vinay has done to lead up to why he's working on Materium and how he thinks about the world today. First of all, Vinay, welcome.
Hey, good to be back.
And you are, if I remember right, based in London?
Yes, just a bit north of London.
I am outside New York City, and so we're in that North Atlantic belt. I'm going to kind of switch to this screen view, and let's dive straight into this. You put this together in 2010 after your work with the Hexayurt. You were thinking, if I remember right, of 100,000 people in tents, what else would they need and what would you need to ship there? And why don't we start there?
Yeah, exactly. So the question was, you know, if you've got a refugee city, you know, you roll out the Hexayurts, what else do you need to ship? You know, you're going to ship the building materials, you're going to ship the tools. This will give them long-term shelter. They will be warm. They will be cool. The buildings, you know, they're pretty good. They work. But what else do you send, right? Do you need water filters? Do you need blankets? Do you need mosquito nets? So the attempt was to try and figure out a kind of design language for all of the protective systems that you'd have to ship alongside of the buildings. And I spent quite a lot of time looking at this through the lens of the Rocky Mountain Institute critical infrastructure model. So, you know, they talk about seven infrastructures. So clean water in, grey water out, black water out, storm water management, natural gas in, electricity in, telecommunications in. The American military also have this thing they call SWEAT. So it's, something like sewage, agricultural products, meaning food, energy, telecommunications, and garbage, or, you know, something, I can't remember exactly what it is, trash is somewhere in there. So different groups have these kind of little rubrics for kind of modeling critical infrastructure, but I wanted something with a bit more lifting power. And what I eventually figured out was that what makes critical infrastructure critical is that it keeps you alive. So if we model the systems that keep people alive, we make a list of the threats, we made a list of the things that protect them from those threats, and that became simple critical infrastructure maps. List of threats, list of protections. And critically, this model starts with the individual at the center. So normally planning systems assume that the first priority is continuity of government.
Yes.
So the government figures out the problems that the government will have and solves those problems. And then eventually it gets down to, oh, by the way, the population miserable, we need to fix that as well. So this model explicitly starts with the individual and constructs up, here's the individual, here are the groups, here are the organizations, here's the state, to make it clear to the continuity government thinkers that you have to build up the continuity of government from continuity of people, rather than thinking that you could do continuity of government separate from protection of the population, which is all too common in those kind of planning.
And if I, as my mind rips through the different types of government, it's systemic for every government to first protect itself, and then worry about everything else, right? So that's,
yes,
that's fascinating. Okay, so let's do the following. Let's go through these slides, I've got questions around each one. But I think as we go through these in sequence, we'll get a good thing of it, and then we can kind of have a broader discussion afterwards. All right, so your second slide then is the individual, and talks through these the centricity of the individual. And what I really love here's the six ways an individual can die, right? And let's go straight to what you're trying to protect people from. Injury, heat, cold, hunger, thirst, illness. Those are the six ways. And essentially what you've done here, and is this again your thinking, or is this something that's come from Rocky Mountain Institute or the military? Where did these six ways come from?
I just made a list. You know, it's a pretty commonly agreed list. There's some finagling, like categorizing injury and illness as two separate things was a decision.
Right.
And the reason they're divided that way is that most of illness is actually waterborne disease.
Yeah.
So you'll notice that it goes too hot, too cold, hunger, thirst, illness, injury. So thirst and illness are together because actually waterborne disease is most of your problem. So really water supply means clean water supply, and it's mainly driven by the desire to stop disease spreading rather than the simple desire to stop people running out of water.
Got it. Okay. So that's the individual. Next slide goes into a little more detail on the six ways to die. Shelter protects you from heat and cold. Supply protects you from hunger and thirst. Safety from illness and injury. And then you get to those different, you get into a bit more detail. Anything major you want to say here?
So the thing about supply is that this is basically logistics.
Okay.
Whereas the safety is basically services.
Okay.
So they're kind of, they're grouped out and they're clustered because this model is a bureaucratic model. It's an administrative model. You know, you have a bunch of entities. They're trying to work together to take care of people. You need to provide them with some guidance on how to clump like with like.
Mm-hmm.
So anybody that's concerned about shelter, well, you know, the easiest shelter, the first shelter is clothing.
Right.
And so you can sort of put the clothing people and the housing people are kind of speaking the same language about what the problems are. Are we going to heat these houses, or are we going to get people a ton more warm clothing, which what's easier to do in the circumstance we're in?
Right. Okay.
Similarly, you know, the food and water situation, the worst case scenario for water is you have to bring it in plastic bottles.
Yeah.
But if you've got good logistics, you can always get water in there if you have to. You'd much rather, you know, take it from some sort of like a municipal pipe or a well, but if you have to take it in a truck, you can. And then the services model, you know, healthcare is partly logistics, but it's mostly just having skilled people in the field who are just like, okay, we're going to need to splint that. And so you start thinking about the personnel question of, do you need peacekeepers? Do you have medical staff? Do you have, you know, somebody from the UN? Like, who's actually doing medical? Who's actually doing sort of safety, this kind of stuff?
Okay. So one is one is supply, and the other one is repeat those two again from the beginning.
So you've got shelter, you've got supply, and you've got safety.
Okay.
And shelter is mostly like heavy lifting. It's tents or it's buildings.
Yeah.
Supply is regular. You're constantly shipping in more food, and it's mostly logistics. And then safety is mostly about access of skilled personnel, trained personnel. Perfect.
Okay.
Exactly.
Got it. All right. Let's go to the next slide, which is, what do you mean by infrastructure? And I thought this was basically infrastructure at its best and is invisible is one thing I took away from this. But let's cover some of these others that you've got here. How do you think about infrastructure?
Well, so the core thing is that infrastructure is just the systems that keep you alive.
Mm.
And those systems are remarkably personalized. So if you're an insulin-dependent diabetic, your infrastructure is the infrastructure supply, is the insulin supply chain above all other things, right? You can lose power to your house and heat and all the rest of that kind of stuff, but when it hits the insulin supply chain, this is when you have a problem.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're a 22-year-old Marine, you know, for you, critical infrastructure is basically mud. You know, you'll be fine.
Right.
You know, that's okay. You can make it. So we have to think of the infrastructures as being what supports a specific individual. And that ranges from practically nothing, from young, strong, trained military personnel, to think of the, you know, infrastructure footprint of an intensive care ward.
Right.
And so, you know, it's not one size fits all. And people have different degrees of vulnerability to different kinds of infrastructure disruption in the infrastructure tail that we all silently pull around with us. So, you know, you and I both have these silent, invisible infrastructure tales, which is, you know, like, well, I'm drinking water out of a bottle here, right? And, you know, it's fizzy and it's bubbly, but the fundamental thing is this is critical infrastructure for me right now.
Yeah. My coffee that I just finished.
Right.
Got it. Okay. Next slide. Layers of infrastructure. I thought this reminded me a lot of Stuart Brand's PACE layers. Right, you kind of go, and I like the way you've got the individual again at the center. Then you've got household, neighborhood, village, municipality, region, country, and then the global. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Again, this seems, what I like about all of these is they're pretty exhaustive. Right, there's not much more you have than this, and therefore, if you have boundaries around the different layers, you know you've got it 99.9% covered against most eventualities in this case. Anything you want to comment around on the different layers?
Yeah. So in a natural crisis, what a person is going to do is they're going to draw this thing out usually in a spreadsheet, and they're going to name these layers for their actual context. So they're going to say my neighborhood is actually the people that live in my apartment building rather than the people that live in my village.
Right.
Or they're going to say their neighborhood is, you know, the people that live, you know, 4 kilometers down the street because they live in rural Alaska and there's just nobody close to them. So, you know, you kind of start by defining your terms. Similarly, you know, when you start talking about municipality in America, typically you would have county and also city. So you'd have probably two layers at municipality, sometimes maybe three. And then in America, region, sometimes that would refer to state, like state of California. Sometimes it would refer to something like, if you think of Kansas City, Missouri, you know, your region is going to be the city, and it's across actually both of these jurisdictional boundaries.
Yeah.
So as you as you draw this thing, what you're drawing is a chain of bureaucratic institutions that are kind of nested inside each other like Matryoshka dolls.
Yes. It's fascinating to me how important the county layer is in the U.S. And it's only ever comes up in natural disasters or whatever. You know, a tornado hits Broward County. And like, if you're a normal person, you have no idea where Broward County is. You've barely even heard of it. It never comes up in day-to-day life, except for when there's a disaster, and then nobody knows what it is. But in general, these are good layers in terms of how to think about it. All right, let me get to the next one, which is the four tiers of cooperation. And here I have a few questions. You've got your four tiers as individual, a group, an organization, and the nation state, right? And these are levels at which these infrastructure is delivered, or the levels at which the government or the supply side can handle it? Why do you have these four layers? Let's start there.
Okay. So these things are here largely as a way of categorizing the entities that show up in a crisis.
Okay.
So it's a typology of the things which are observed in the field. And those things are basically, you've got individuals wandering around. Okay, fine. The groups are a very movable feast. It can range from, you know, a large family right the way up to something like a church group. So it could be from, you know, two or three people functionally like a group, more usually a dozen or two, right up to several hundred people with a kind of loose chain of command, right? But the thing that separates those groups, like if you think of something like food distribution, right? You have a church group, they're doing food distribution, versus you've got, say, a government bureaucracy doing food distribution. The interfaces with the rest of the disaster management framework are completely different if you're dealing with a group versus if you're dealing with an institution.
Okay.
And the rules of engagement are very different, because although you might have, you know, 200 people in a church group and 200 people from FEMA doing the same job of food distribution, you're dealing with two completely different structures, styles, strategies, approaches, governance models. They feel very different in practice.
Yeah.
Even though there's often a substantial overlap in capability, the social organizations are so different that they need to be handled very differently in planning and in modeling and in response.
Okay. I got a little lost in the distinction between group and organization. So, you know, a group, I can see it's coming from, again, built up out of the individual, right? It could be everybody on the street that's just been hit by a tornado or something, or the neighborhood that's been hit by a snowstorm. Where does organization come into this? Is this like the FEMA that you just mentioned, or is this something a little bit more specific?
So for me, the three salient things that make an organization different from a group is that you have explicit chain of command.
Okay.
Right. So that's the first thing, is when you say who is in charge, there is a single, unique, correct answer. And that answer usually has legal force.
Got it.
Right. Bob is the CEO. Fred is the colonel in charge of this base. You know, whatever it happens to be, there's a distinct, direct, correct answer.
My mind pops to the Die Hard movies where the FBI shows up and says, we're in charge now.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Okay. And, you know, sometimes they are and sometimes they're not. So the second thing is actually more important, which is the groups have an explicit shared map of reality. The organizations have an explicit shared map of reality. So if you are a group of citizens on a street and there is flooding and you're all working together and you have a group which has a response capability, those people could have completely different models of the situation, right? One person says the flood will be gone in a week. Another person says we're going to be here for 3 months. Somebody says we're going to be evacuated. Somebody says, no, we're not going to be stuck here. They can understand the situation in radically different ways. And they don't necessarily have to sort out what they believe to be collectively real before they can take action.
Right.
Right. Because in a sense, they're activity focused rather than decision focused.
Okay.
You come to a proper, you know, kind of organizational type group, something along these lines, you know, something that has the organizational template, the organization has an explicit, clear, reified, shared understanding of the situation.
Got it.
Right. We are firefighters. Our job is to take care of the evacuation of these people from these two towns. And the way that we are going to do that is, you know, we're going to use the equipment or hardware and the training that we've already got, plus support from the federales. And that map of reality is shared by the entire institution. It's the institutional world model.
We can't call this a disaster unless you're 6 feet underwater. And they have these rules, et cetera, on how they operate.
They have these rules, et cetera, right? Okay. And that explicit map of reality then also generates a plan, which is a plan relative to the map, right? Because our job is to evacuate these two towns before the fire closes and the roads, we will then do, these people will go here and they'll protect this bridge, and these people will go here and they'll spray down those trees, and these people will go here and they'll fell that, or whatever the, you know, whatever the actual operational thing is. But if the situation moves away from the map of reality that the organization has, you begin to get frame drag. The organization does the wrong thing because the explicit world model is now in error and they can't correct it in time.
Right.
Whereas groups tend to suffer from disorganization. They don't really know what's going on and everybody kind of does their own thing and sometimes they do it together. The groups tend to be more responsive to changes in circumstances, whereas the organizations tend to drag frame of them a little.
Right. Okay. Got it. We're here to do this, and it's, if it's outside the scope, we can't help you. Yeah. Got it. Okay. And then where do you see the nation state coming into this?
Well, so last thing an organization is, the thing which really defines an organization is shared succession model.
Okay.
So the leader, catches, I don't know, dysentery or something like that, or the chain of command gets broken down because you can no longer radio for instructions because the radio stopped working. And at that point, they have a way of failing over to a new authority. And this is the critical distinction between groups and organizations, is that in an organizational structure, somebody is always in charge and there's an agreed procedure for who that somebody will be. So you wind up with a continuity of leadership almost regardless of circumstances, whereas groups can have informal leadership and then the informal leadership somehow drop out. And suddenly the group's capability just falls through the floor because now they're spending all their time figuring out who's in charge. So that continuity of leadership and the ability to use a procedure for agreeing who is the new leader when something goes wrong,
right?
That is absolutely the critical distinguishing thing between the groups and the organizations.
Okay. And then how do you distinguish organization to nation state?
So a nation state is a complicated beast. The model that I use of the nation state is intended to model things like civil wars reasonably well. So in places where the nature of the nation state is in extremis and things are very distressed, there are a set of attributes that define the nation state. So functionally speaking, there are kind of five functions. And then philosophically speaking, there is a single differentiator. Right. So the line of state-like or not state-like is a sort of philosophical concept. And then functionally speaking, the state has kind of five functions, like a metabolism. So the five functions are, the state has a list of citizens that it claims authority over. Right.
Yeah.
And it kind of helps if we think of like a boat, right? So on a boat, a captain is essentially the nation state. The captain is the king of the boat. The captain has authority. And boats are a nice little model that we can kind of model it out on a boat, and then you can apply it to the land-based stuff. So you have a captain. The first thing is the captain has a list of all the people that are on his boat, and these are all the people that are under the captain's authority. I am the captain, this is my ship, these are my people, and I'm responsible to take care of them. Right? So list of citizens, first thing you got. Second thing you have is a map of territory.
Yeah.
right? We're on this boat. That's our territory. You know, we're in the blue ocean, or, you know, we are the government of, you know, Rhineland, you know, civil, you know, local government, Rhineland, and this is our patch. That's our thing. That map of territory, you could have multiple nation states that all have claim to the same territory. You could also have weird anomalies where you've got a chunk of land that nobody wants. You know, like in a war zone, you could have a chunk of territory nobody is sending troops into there because it's not a priority. It's also very clear that nobody's really in charge.
Hmm.
So it's not that the Earth naturally divides up into nation state units and every single square meter magically attaches to one nation state or another nation state. In actual practice, there are lots of places where multiple nation states lay claim. There are also places where no nation state lays claim.
Yeah.
And those are tend to be de facto rather than de jure definitions. So the third thing is you need a list of, if you, you need a set of effective organizations. So the captain of the ship needs to be able to give commands and say, right, could somebody please figure out what is happening with the engines, and could somebody please figure out what's happening with the radio? And there has to be somebody that can act as an effective arm of the state.
Right. So the nation state sits above and manages the organizations that are in any particular area of jurisdiction. And then that way also they can adjudicate more resources if the Navy's not got enough resources, they send in the Coast Guard or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yep, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Got it. All right.
Right. So effective organizations. And the word effective is tacked on the front of that for very good reasons. Because if you have ineffective organizations, you kind of sort of lose sovereignty.
Yeah.
You know, you have to be able to actually solve problems. And the way the nation states solve problems is through their organizations. As a nation state's organizations decay, the state itself begins to lose sovereignty. So the next thing that you need to be a nation state is you need legal jurisdiction.
Yes. I remember now, this, I'm just going to point back to my favorite, one of my favorite definitions of yours, which is the nation states has the legal right to inflict violence on its citizens.
No, not quite.
That wasn't it?
Not quite.
Damn, I almost said it. Okay, what is it?
So close. So this is the philosophical differentiator, right? So okay. The thing that makes you state-like or not state-like is that you have the ability to retroactively or proactively pardon crime.
Pardon crime, that was it. Okay, right? Yes.
So you retroactively pardon theft, you get you proactively pardon theft, you get tax collectors. You retroactively pardon murder, you have, for example, intelligence agents that had to shoot somebody in an emergency.
Now, is that a framing that you came up with, or have you seen that elsewhere? It's the most unique framing I've ever seen about statehood.
So Max Weber is the guy who has this notion that the state has the monopoly on legitimate violence.
That was it. Okay, we were
quoting. And that's generally accepted. Most people think of that as being like, okay, that's what it is. The problem is that if you get a highly contested area, so here I'm thinking of like bits of Ireland during the Trump, bits of Gaza, you know, Lebanon during periods of civil war, you know, you can wind up with a single patch of dirt with two different groups of people sharing that patch of dirt.
Yeah.
With effectively two separate judicial systems running on top of each other in the same place. So if you think of some situation with, I don't know, take Israeli settlers, right? There is a chain of command which will handle, say, you know, one Palestinian stealing another Palestinian's bicycle. There's another chain of command which will cover one Israeli settler punching another Israeli settler in a bar fight.
Yeah.
Right. And when you get a conflict between the Israeli settlers and the Palestinian locals, which jurisdiction is going to be used is what indicates who's really in charge at that point.
Right.
So what you have is this kind of complex, layered, para-sovereign mess, right? Hmm. And the Weber model is a very poorly behaved animal in that situation because the Weber model assumes that there's only kind of one entity contesting for statehood.
Right.
So you take this situation, you say, what's the government? Well, to some degree, the Palestinian government structure can say, okay, this person, you don't arrest this person for this thing that they did. Very sorry, they're with us, not for you. Likewise, the Israelis can do the same thing with their people.
The other example that
to springs, a limited degree.
Yeah, the other example that springs to mind is UN diplomats operating in a certain country. They have a certain set of rules that apply to them, diplomatic immunity, et cetera, et cetera. Okay.
Exactly.
All right. Let me pop. Go ahead.
And so this is really important because it frames this notion of compound sovereignty, right? Anywhere in the world that you go, I am an American citizen, will get you a certain kind of protection. And that is because you have national sovereignty and they can pardon crime from their people. But then you also have kind of Pax Americana, and that's a slightly different kind of sovereignty. And for a given individual in a given patch of dirt, there could be as many as 4, 5, 6 different entities that have some state-like capability relative to that person.
Got it.
It's very not cut and dried. And again, this is very much optimized for disasters and civil wars and war zones and all the rest of this. But correctly identifying who has power is quite difficult. And being able to say, right, well, okay, so who has the ability to pardon crime? Who has the ability to authorize seizure of property because we need it somewhere else? Who has the ability to put armed people in the field and not have them regarded as criminals?
And I love I love the retroactive and proactive aspect of it. That's fantastic. Mm-hmm. You cut through a lot. It's incredibly elegant, I must say.
I was very happy when I figured that out. Thank you, Saloon. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Let's cut down into these things then. Okay. I'm on the next slide, which is skim map for group, right? And yeah. We've talked about this to some extent already. But when you talk about groups, we talked about the fact that they're bottom up. They tend to have emergent leadership potentially. The thing they need are communication, space, transportation, and resource control.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Again, these seem pretty decently exhaustive. Food is in there in resource control?
No, all that stuff is at the individual level.
Okay.
So your group is made of individuals. The individual is hungry. So you take care of the individual needs at the individual level of the model.
Hmm.
And then the things which cause a set of individuals to form a group are communications. They need to be able to reach each other to be a group. Transport, they generally need to be able to physically co-locate. And then workspaces, they need a place to physically co-locate.
Okay.
And generally speaking, groups need two of the three. So if you have transport and you have communications, you could find some place to meet. If you have a place to meet and transport, people could go there and see what's going on. You know, there's a certain amount of flexibility.
Got it. Okay.
Sorry, I have hiccups.
No worries. Next one then, organization.
We're skipping resource control.
Okay, go for resource control.
So the first 9 parts of the model are physical. Too hot, too cold, hunger, thirst, illness, injury, communications, transport, workspace. Right?
Okay.
Resource control is the beginning of the bureaucratic 9. So the bureaucratic structure, resource control is who's got the bus, who is using the radio right now, who's got the keys to the workshop.
Got it.
And resource control is the boundary of one group versus other groups or versus individuals.
Okay.
So the fact that those resources are held by the group structure rather than by individuals is a boundary both between the group resources and the individuals that make up the group, but also between the group and other groups, organizations, and the state.
Okay.
So the resource control is that it's like the membrane around the group is our communications, our transport, our workspace, not somebody else's.
Got it. Okay. Let's move to organization. And here we've talked about this a little bit already. Shared map, shared plans, shared succession model.
Yeah.
Right. And the one that strikes out to me the most here is shared succession model, because groups could have a shared map or a shared plan, but succession model is often lacking. But an organization definitely can fix this. Now, you've got examples here of hospitals, police forces, fire brigades, schools, et cetera, et cetera.
Yep.
Okay.
And that line between groups and organizations, you know, it's a very fuzzy line when you deal with things like a militia group.
Yeah.
You know, and that fading out of something goes from being a group to being an organization, it's a very fluid territory. You know, so you can have things that are called organizations, which are actually just groups. You can have things which are called groups, which are actually function like organizations. So it's a kind of, you know, it's almost like a point scoring system. Like, well, do they have this? Do they have this? Do they have this? Well, that's actually kind of an organization, isn't it? You know, it's sort of, you know, we could talk to the leadership And in a group, you often have to canvas more or less all of them to figure out if you could get the group to do something or change its mind.
Hmm.
Whereas in an organization, you might only have to talk to a few people. You know, functionally speaking, it makes a difference, kind of sort of how you're framing it.
And you can get a blurring of the lines at the group, organization, and even nation state level. Say if you take a warlord in Somalia, right, who kind of blurs across all of those different lines. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, folks, Salim here. I am so excited about our latest launch, the Exponential Organizations 2.0 book. It's a living book. This baby is a living, breathing, always up-to-date source of knowledge on the latest technologies and techniques for transforming organizations and building 10x growth and impact. How do we build a better future using the latest and greatest 21st century techniques? And the best part, you don't have to do anything. You just sign up for our basic tier, which is only $4 a month. And boom, you have instant access plus an AI chatbot interface into the book. You can cancel anytime. But there's more. We have a community of technologists, entrepreneurs, innovators, disruptors, thought leaders that we can exchange ideas with. You can tap into that ecosystem to build your dream. What is your massive transformative purpose? And the book plus the ecosystem and our community is set up for you to help leverage that and build it. So come along. It's a mind-boggling capability that we've built. Trust me on this and come and see us. Can we move on to nation state?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, nation state. So here you've got, we've talked again already, jurisdiction, citizens, territory, effective organizations, and some sort of international recognition.
Yes.
Okay. I want to get your opinion. We've talked a bit about this already, Balaji's, Srinivasan's idea of the network state. Mm-hmm. I have an issue with the international recognition part of it, where people spend forever trying to get international recognition, can take decades, right? There are essentially, what he's suggesting is that groups can become their own nation state if they get international recognition, right? And why do we need physical territory in order to navigate this? And I think here we come into a really huge kind of conflict between the digital and the physical world of who has control of the territory and what's considered the nation state or not. And have you thought about this a bit, and how do you react to that?
So the SCIM model is very much rooted in crisis management.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of designed for, you know, you kind of have a town, there's flooding, there's fire, there's a large-scale infrastructure outage. The mayor, the chief of the police, the hospital administrator, the firefighters, you know, a bunch of pretty well-organized local Boy Scout groups and a few others kind of all rock up to the parking lot of the school, and everybody sits around in the, you know, kind of gymnasium figuring out what they're going to do to keep everything running until the bridge reopens and everything settles down again. So in that model, you get a bunch of whiteboards, you get a bunch of markers, you draw out the diagrams, people write down everything they understand. All the people that are working on keeping people warm are now in a cluster and they're talking to each other about how we keep people warm. All the people that are trying to make sure that people have clean water to drink, they're all kind of speaking the same language in a different corner of the space. And it provides a sort of format for people that are already in the situation and already have some resources and capabilities in their organizations and their groups to sort of work together to hold everything together at the food and water and healthcare level.
Right.
Until the situation kind of normalizes.
Okay.
So when we start looking at things like, you know, what does it take to turn, you know, Disneyland into a country, right? This model is not really optimized for solving that problem.
Got it.
I mean, I have some thoughts about it because obviously I've thought a bunch about sovereignty, but, you know, my kind of feeling is that, most of the time, the sovereignty that counts is de facto rather than de jure, right?
Yes.
You know, most people don't really want to be buying tanks and patrolling their borders. What they really want is like a ski town where the sheriff turns a blind eye to people bringing in bales of weed for their reggae festival.
Right.
You know, like what they're kind of looking for is sort of selectively permissioned environments.
Yeah.
They kind of want to be able to retract the inconvenient laws for a while, do your thing, but they're not really looking to have like armies and stuff, you know?
Okay. And I think painting this as, you know, aiming at disaster relief, et cetera, is a good one because, you know, you're kind of putting the safety net at the survival existential level, and then we can work up from there. Like the nation state is kind of like, okay, nice to have, good discussion, but let's make sure we survive first. Okay.
I mean, it does matter, right? You've got to be able to figure out who's making rules. There are a bunch of huge global social problems. It'd be nice if we had some social innovation on.
Yeah.
You know, like, so for me, something that I think needs innovation is care of opiate dependent drug users.
Yep.
Right. So, you know, nobody seems to have a decent way of handling people that are addicted to opiates.
Yeah.
If we had 25 different jurisdictions that were trying completely different regimes, you know, these folks over here have legalized heroin, these people over here have a licensed addict scheme, these people over here let people grow opium at home, but they're not allowed to refine it. You know, you could try lots of different approaches in different jurisdictions on a thing which is the core business of the state, find some models that work, start learning from it, start exporting it. These, you know, like, you know, because somebody figures out a decent way of managing populations that are dependent on opiates that works, that knowledge is something that could be saving lives and saving, you know, families all over the world.
Yes.
So the need for innovation and governance, I absolutely see the need for innovation and governance. It's just, you know, the thing that I've worked on is just the meat and potatoes business of where's the food? Where's the water? You know, how's this kind of working? Materium, of course, is a bit of a different animal because Materium takes a lot of these very subtle understandings of sovereignty and, you know, looks at it from the perspective of regulation of international trade as a commercial service. But that, again, is a very different thing because, you know, to regulate international trade at a commercial level, this is not a thing that you need a country for. This is what Visa does. This is what the International Swaps and Derivatives Association does. So commercial trade regulators that aren't international, they have very, very slightly state-like attributes sometimes, but not in any kind of meaningfully sovereign sense. It's just that they're an international rulemaker.
Okay. All right. I'm gonna skip to the next one because this is where I'm the most lost. You've got a wonderful, colorful couple of slides here. Called the state failure map, right?
Yes.
And I think this is fantastic because in one table, you've got the too hot, too cold. Then you've got the resource control. Then you've got shared succession. You've got the different layers of the individual, the group, the etc. And then you've got it mapped out again on the left. So explain this table to us.
Okay, so let's go down to the second one, because it's a little clearer than the first one. The first one is just kind of sketching a model. The second one actually has some worked examples.
Okay, so this one, I'm on this colorful slide with individuals across the top, individual, household, village, region, world, and then down the down the left, the groupings of injuries, six ways to die, space, transport, shared succession, and then the nation state stuff. Go for it.
So let's start with the axes. So going down vertically, first of all, so the first group of six is individuals, second group of six is groups, third group of three is the organizations, and then the final group of five is the state.
Okay.
And so what we're doing is for each one of these entries, we are looking at, say, thirst, and we're reading across to figure out what it is that's taking care of the thirst need. So we read across from thirst. Individuals, generally speaking, have no access to water themselves. Households get it from a water supply, which is a tap in a building. Then that gets it usually from the water mains, but in some instances it would be a well. Then this goes out to water processing, which is usually municipal.
Got it.
Right. And so if you were doing this stuff for a real crisis, you would sit down and you would say, right, Bob from the water company, where does our water come from? Oh, well, it comes from the reservoir up on the hill. How does it get down here? Well, it's gravity fed. So if we lose electricity, will the water still come? Well, we'd have to go up there and we'd have to manually open a couple of pump gates with, you know, a wrench. But yeah, we could do that. Okay, great. So we have water supply sorted out. Oh, well, but and then you get 20 minutes of complicated stuff. But the answer is it's basically sorted. Right.
Right.
you get to somewhere else, it's like, well, where's our water supply? Well, it's coming from Colorado, and we live in Arizona. Oh, so if something is disrupted, the water stops. Yeah. Okay, so what's our plan B? How much water do we have in Walmart? And so what you're doing is you're just organizing the resources at each one of these levels. The town has two Walmarts. The Walmarts have 25,000 gallons of drinkable liquids in them. Your town has 3,800 people, and you're like, okay, so we get 3 days of drinkables in the Walmart. Okay, fine.
Hmm.
That's our buffer, right? And so this ability to basically go through and look at each one of these boxes, you're not just mapping how much resource there is, you're also mapping who has administrative control of the resource.
Yeah. Okay.
So if we wanted to take the liquid out of the Walmart, Walmart is an organization, and we have to contact the Walmart organization to ask whether we can have their liquid.
Got it. Now, I noticed there's very little in the space layer. Is that because it kind of is less relevant than, because you've got a very rich treatment for communications, right? You've got households, mm-hmm. you really need electricity to provide communications. Neighborhood wise, you need cell towers and cables, local hubs, mm-hmm. regional fiber lines, and then undersea. By the way, yeah. the one of my favorite little things about communications is the most competitive mobile phone markets in the world are Somalia.
Really?
Because the warlords have basically come to an agreement to not bomb each other's cell phone towers, because it's a lose-lose. It's just, so they all compete, and they have the lowest cell phone prices in the world because they're all competing on price. And they're not, it's just this wonderful example of co-opetition.
That's amazing.
So space is not dealt with. Is that deliberate or just it's not relevant in a survival space because you've got all these other things that are much more important? And the second question I've got, what are the color codings here?
So the color codings are just to... Oh, okay, let's deal with space first. So the thing with space is it's either there or it's not, right? You know, people have their houses... you know, they have their buildings, they have the this, that, and the next thing, but it's not something that is mutable in a crisis.
Right.
Right. It's either there or it's not. You know, you could make an argument, okay, well, you know, we're going to repurpose the school into a disaster relief building, something along these kind of lines. But generally speaking, it's just something where it's assumed into the model because you either have access to it or you don't.
Got it.
It's not part of a matrix of interdependencies, I guess is what I'm saying.
Okay, makes sense. And you've got diesel generators bleeding into space, which I guess you need space to. And is there a reason for some things being red?
Yes. So the stuff which is red indicates basically the power line. So everything to do with electricity, fuel supply, this kind of stuff is red. The food line is green.
Okay, yep.
Blue is the legal. Exactly.
Okay.
Yep. Government registers and stuff like that are in the kind of purple color, and you get some fading over.
Yeah. This is awesome. Okay. Jurisdiction, legal processes. And there's...
Yeah. So
go ahead.
Let me pick out two features here. So at the individual level, there's this part labeled resilience gap.
Yeah.
So generally speaking, the individual can generate practically none of their own needs.
Yeah.
So almost everything in our society is organized at the household level, but if you take an individual, they can't really do very much to take care of themselves at all. And survivalists and so on are generally operating to try and bolster the individual resilience level. Folks like transition towns or neighborhood survivalist groups will tend to be working more at a kind of household and neighborhood level.
And group level, yeah.
But there's so much fragility because we have almost nothing at the individual level in the resilience gap. So that whole thing where the government says, okay, every American ought to have a 72-hour kit where they can walk out the front door with 3 days of food, 3 days of water, all their legal documents, basic medications, and maybe a mask in their bag. If everybody had done just that, then even in really large-scale crises, you don't have to worry so much for the first 3 days. Right? But it doesn't matter how much we tell people, get a 72-hour kit together. Almost nobody that doesn't live in a hurricane area has a 72-hour kit.
Right.
And so that individual resilience gap is really large. And the fact that you can't just walk into Walmart and walk out with a cardboard box called Walmart 72-hour kit and it's got the stuff in it and you're sorted. You know, the fact that we've had America an elevated level of stress about disasters and terrorism for 20 years since 9/11, and you still can't go into Walmart and walk out with the Walmart box that has all your three-day stuff in it. There is just a huge psychological problem around provisioning basic needs in a disciplined way in the commercial supply chain.
Wow, that's very true. I wonder why that is. Have you ever thought about that? I'm sure you have.
Yep.
Why is that?
People are insane.
Okay, explain that. If I'm Walmart, I could imagine having that 72-hour kit and it would sell like hotcakes.
The problem is that nobody can agree what goes in the box.
I got it.
Right?
Right.
And so nobody's willing to take legal responsibility for telling people this is what goes in the box.
Right, right.
And so the government shirks the responsibility and says, not our circus, not our monkeys. Walmart's lawyers say, did you say we should do this in the box?
Yeah.
Sir, we are Walmart, right? we sell dog food and we sell bicycles, but we are not going to take that executive responsibility for telling people this box will keep them alive. Hmm. Surely FEMA, you would like to tell us this. FEMA is like, well, it depends.
Yeah. God.
And you know, like normally, and what happens is that the concept dies in the bureaucratic thicket.
Right.
So rather than solving it to 98% and then accepting, oh, you needed a can opener in the box because we didn't put a can opener in the box and you didn't have a can opener at home. And then you cut yourself with a knife when you opened the box with a chisel. Oh boy, wow. And rather, because the thing is so litigious and the profit margin's low and the government is, you know, without use of sovereign authority to protect the retailers from any kind of backlash, what happens is that everybody shirks the load and then it lands on the individuals. And the only individuals that are willing to pick it up, generally speaking, are engineers or doctors.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? Systemic then, thinking about risk.
Mean, in Miami, you kind of have a list of stuff that you should keep around and everybody tailors it for their own needs, et cetera, et cetera. So very funny. All right. Can I skip through to the next slide? Because we're going to run out of time if we don't kind of go through. Or do you have something more to say about all of this?
Yeah. So the second thing this is actually the last slide with much substance on it.
Okay.
So the last thing that we really want to look at here is the bottom right-hand corner, right? So the bottom right-hand corner is a real adventure land, and this is the mystery of sovereignty.
Okay.
So the legitimacy of the state comes from the consent of the governed. You can see that's on the international recognition line.
Yeah.
Jurisdiction requires legal processes, but those processes only work inside of land that you have and sovereign identity. You know, you need identity, you need some kind of sovereign land. To figure all that stuff out, you sort of need land registries. Those are usually stored at a subnational level, usually the county. And so what you have is a whole bunch of things that all point to each other in the thing that generates the mystery of sovereignty. It's like those roofs where you've got, you know, each plank is lying on the plank in front of it. I think they call them a reciprocal roof.
Yeah.
Sovereign or an arch. Sovereignty is all these things that kind of lean on each other just so, and it creates a thing that the international machinery recognizes as, oh yeah, that is actually a state. And when that unravels, what goes is you lose effective legal jurisdiction.
Yeah.
And when you lose effective legal jurisdiction, what happens is corporations are no longer able to share property inside of the corporate body.
Yeah.
So you take a power grid, the national court system stops working, the workers start stealing bits of the power grid and taking them home, generators, battery backups, you know, radios, all the rest of that stuff begins to get pulled out of because there's no legal accountability anymore. The folks that are managing to keep the grid running in their neighborhood because, you know, there's a coal-fired power plant, they keep the trucks running, cut off the connections to the rest of the grid because they're just taking care of their city and they can't manage the rest of, you know, like they just can't keep it connected to the grid and keep it running because the grid doesn't work properly. So you begin to get the balkanization of the national grid and so you go from a highly efficient shared system with enormous economies of scale through to eventually everybody that has power has their own diesel generator. And the resulting collapse in overall systemic efficiency is what turns you into a failed state.
Okay. Presumably, you could take a country, right?
Mm-hmm.
and layer it over this slide as a heat map and go, okay, this country is really, or a town or something, is really good at these levels, but not so great at these levels, and this one, forget about it, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Have people done that yet? Because this seems incredibly powerful to do that, because then you'll find your absolute weak spots and where you need to focus more. But that, mm-hmm. which if you're in, so speak about that. Have people thought about that?
Well, and so if you're in Phoenix, Arizona,
okay,
your problem is lack of water and too much heat.
Yeah.
Right. If you're in, some small town in the north end of Minnesota, your problem is cold.
Yeah.
And maybe getting food up there if the roads are all snowed up.
Yeah.
So the reason that people have not used this model very much in the last 15 years, right? The first version of this was called Six Ways to Die. U.S. Department of Defense got quite interested in it. They did a whole bunch of work kind of teaching people this model there. There was a set of events called Star Tides where it was used very extensively, and I think they're still using it. That was also coordinated by my former boss, a guy called Lynn Wells, who was at the time DOD CIO, so you know, had quite senior engagement.
Hmm.
But the problem is when you sit down and apply this model, it kind of scares people silly.
Well, I guess the reason is people are in their particular swim lane, right? I'm an organization. Mm-hmm. I'm an institution doing this, I'm etc. And this kind of spreads across all of that. And you very quickly see the limitations of your own world. And then you kind of go, oh, we can't do any of that. We can't do much of this. Just walk away from the map.
Is that it's one the, reason? That's a lot of it. Okay. But it's also just the sort of problems hiding in plain sight. We call these black elephants.
Okay.
So the black elephant in the room, and after it goes on the rampage, everybody will say it was a black swan.
Right.
Black okay. elephants, right. The black elephant is another one of my proud inventions. We had a team in London called the Institute for Collapsonomics, which was an economic collapse think tank. And so we invented the term collapsonomics, which was the study of systems when they leave the economic sphere but continue to function to some degree.
Okay.
So that's like war zone economies or systems in social collapse. And then that group also coined the term black elephant. And so this kind of model, right? And actually that group has produced some interesting things. My friend Dugald Hine is one of the members of the original collapsonomics group. He's just published a book called something like Working in the Ruins, which is a book about climate change. Lloyd Davis has gone off and is doing a whole bunch of local resilience stuff, kind of community care, community services. I'm not as close Lloyd as contact with Lloyd as I ought to be. So people have gone off in different directions on different things. So the thing which is at the heart of this is a tool. It's like a dowsing rod for finding black elephants.
I love that framing. A dowsing rod for finding black elephants. Okay, got it.
Right. So yeah. The big black elephant in the States is medical supply chain. Right. Insulin dependent diabetics. It's 1-3% of the population. I don't remember what the number is offhand. But then you got all the people that are dependent on a variety of things like heart medications, antidepressants, anti-anxiety drugs, just the things where people will become completely dysfunctional in a crisis if they don't get their meds or they'll die. And the percentage right. of the population that's dependent on this stuff is terrifyingly
large. Very high.
Tens, right? Yeah. Tens of millions of Americans.
I mean, the stat that freaks me out every time I hear it is the average American has 7 prescriptions.
Wow, I didn't know that. That's crazy.
It's just, it just blows your mind, right? Mm-hmm. So and there's a lot that don't have that many. So there's some, you know, there's the mean and median around that is insane. So
polypharmacy.
So the resiliency of that is absolutely critical in, and how do you think about that is really critical. Now,
yep.
Where would you worry that this map, it's very well optimized for survival, and mm-hmm. and I love that aspect of it. It doesn't really deal much for the exact same reason. It doesn't really deal much with culture, right?
Oh, it very explicitly 100% doesn't touch culture with a barge pole.
So what would it look like if you created a cultural map around these types of, you know, what I find fascinating is you've got this exhaustive list of the individual, the group, the organization, the nation state, right? Mm-hmm. You could come up with something really fascinating around different elements of this, like culture or money or values mm-hmm. or religions mm-hmm. or something. It would be really fascinating mm-hmm. to do that work. To get yes. to get a clear sense of how the going back to kind of some of our other discussions, I'm fascinated from a metaphysical perspective of the concept of layers.
Yes.
Right. I remember when I first came across the OSI stack. If you're a computer mm-hmm. geek, mm-hmm. then you'll know that you have a data layer and a presentation layer and a transport layer to get information around, etc. And each one is completely independent. But the stack yields systemic outputs, and you've got enormous interdependency.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And I love the layering aspect because each of these is a separate layer in itself. But if you can navigate this collectively, then this works very well. Do you find any institutions that work effectively across these different layers? Because I'm struggling to think of any.
So. The institutions themselves don't get to work across layers.
Yeah.
Because the nature of the institution is that it just doesn't work across layers. The model that we came up with in when I was doing kind of civil cooperation stuff around DOD was the notion of the fly rod.
Okay.
Right. Or the fishing rod. We got a fishing rod. Being Scottish, I tend to be more differentiate, but you know, let's call it a fishing rod. So on one end of the fishing rod, you have a kind of inch thick carbon fiber tube. And on the other end, you have something which is as thin as a reed and amazingly flexible.
Right.
Right. So the carbon fiber tube end of it is held in the mighty fists of government. And it goes, oof. Right.
Okay.
And then you have organizations which are a lot more flexible. And then you get to the local organizations where, you know, the government says, right, you know, no drink driving. Right. And the sheriff of some massively rural town in the middle of nowhere is like, okay, no drink driving into town. But if you're only driving out towards your farms and you go slow. And you're
going from pub to home in the 300 meters that it takes.
Right. And so, you know, they're going to kind of put the alcohol breathalyzer check on the road that goes to the freeway. And they're going to sort of ignore the fact that the farmers are driving home after four beers.
Yes.
And that sort of flexible enforcement stuff where it's like, you know, look, there's just no other way of doing this. I am really sorry, but we're going to selectively enforce law.
Yeah.
That stuff is way down the framework from the federal mandate that says thou shalt not drink and drive. But if you don't have people doing that kind of stuff, the law becomes completely dysfunctional.
Yes.
Right? So you need officials that have the ability to locally abrogate. Remember what I said about proactively or retroactively pardoning crimes?
Yeah.
So the cop that says, farmers driving home in pickup trucks, we don't do drunk driving stuff on a Friday night, but if anybody's going to the freeway, you pick them up there.
Yeah.
Right? That decision is somebody acting as a sovereign entity.
Yeah.
Right? They are saying, I'm going to proactively pardon these crimes because actually I'm just going to turn a blind eye to this.
And you can get the negative aspect of that too, right? Like you have these police in Texas that are stopping Mexican carloads and going, oh, we think you've got drugs in there. Let's just confiscate everything in your car.
Yeah,
and good luck. You have to sue us to get it back. And they literally leave a family stranded on the side of the road because they've just essentially absconded with all this stuff. It's essentially pure theft by the state for anybody that looks like an immigrant coming across.
And so this kind of selective enforcement stuff, like the state doesn't function without it, but keeping it clean is a nightmare.
Is it tough?
Super tough, right?
Yeah.
Because the fact is the state has to turn a blind eye to selective, what I used to call differential enforcement. The state doesn't function without differential enforcement, but it's also where all the corruption hides.
Okay.
So
let me ask you one other question that really has been sticking in my head as we go through this different map. You've got now the emergence via technology of interesting potential to skip from like world down to individual. Like for example, satellite communications, right? Now if Twitter. I can have a local generator or solar power collector, then essentially I can be on the internet without worrying about any of the intermediate layers And if somebody, Starlink or whoever is providing that service, then we're kind of good to go.
We're having this conversation over Starlink.
Okay, that's apropos right. then.
And my Starlink is connected to an enormous battery.
Yeah.
Right. And if I had any kind of crisis, I'd connect my enormous battery to a solar panel and, you know, basically hang it out in the back garden.
Yeah.
There we are, right? I love that so much. I love it so much.
Yeah, because you've got full resilience now at the very local level. You don't have, so this is one of the things I've been thinking about, and maybe we need a part four for this, right? Which is, how do you, we have an increasing number of things, say vertical farms, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or solar panel, where energy, food, water, essentially, and now satellite communications can be collected at a hyper-local level,
mm-hmm.
and you obviate the need for a lot of the stuff in the middle. And you yes, have incredible absolutely. Resilience now going forward for absolutely. The survival side, right?
Yes. And this is the natural shape of the post-industrial age. There was a point where our services were produced by gigantic factories.
Centralized, yeah.
Right? And now they're produced by what amount to appliances.
Yeah.
Right? My Starlink is an appliance.
Yeah.
Right? It's amazing. Yep. A water filter, like a straw filter.
Yeah.
It's an appliance. Dirty water come in, clean water come out.
Yeah.
But it's an appliance instead of being a factory.
Yeah.
So we're moving into a position where a lot of our infrastructure is now post-industrial infrastructure. And the climate struggle is between industrial and post-industrial infrastructure systems, unless somebody comes up with something like fusion.
Wait. Okay. The climate struggle is industrial versus post-industrial systems.
Yeah, and for infrastructure, yes.
Okay.
So the industrial infrastructure is oil and coal and gas.
Yeah.
The post-industrial infrastructure is wind and solar.
So as we move to a post-industrial in more and more realms, energy, mm-hmm. water, food, et cetera, then mm-hmm. do we end up with do you need to redraw this map pretty radically? Right? Because you can deal with a lot of things at the very hyper-local level and you don't need the power company and you don't need mm-hmm. the national grid and power.
So if you go back to the, if you go back to that slide 11,
okay.
what happens is the right-hand half of that slide is emptying out towards the left.
Yeah.
More and more and more stuff is piling up at the left-hand side. And then on the right-hand side, at the very extreme end, what you have is space, right? Starlink and solar panels, they're just getting services beamed down from space.
Yeah.
Above the national level. So the first version of this chart had above the nation level, above the world level, it had a space level.
Yeah.
And what it said was all the heat comes from the sun directly or indirectly.
Yeah.
Right. The heat goes into the coal, goes into the gas, goes into the oil, or you collect it directly with solar panels. All the cold is the coldness of space, and all the water comes from evaporation.
Hmm.
So actually the sun and the coldness of space drive almost all of the rest of the model.
So I'm thinking of a giant intergalactic mafia that comes along and inserts a big barrier between the sun and the earth. It says, we're going to need some tax from you, like something like 10% of your GDP resources, etc., for us to remove this.
Isn't that called Goldman Sachs?
By the way, one of my favorite statistics talking about systemic corruption, etc., 40% of American corporate profits for the last decade, 40% go to the financial services sector. That's just an unbelievable statistic, right? It's just
amazing.
It's kind of incredible.
I mean, I basically wound up in financial services, you know, like that's where I wound up when I needed to figure out how to make a living after 20 years of doing disaster relief work that didn't really pay. I wound up starting a tech company, but it's a tech company that's essentially financial services because, you know, I needed to make a living and that's where the money was.
Yeah. There's something really interesting about that though, right? We're at a point where if you're an educated, sophisticated enough individual, you can dip in and out of these as you need to.
Mm-hmm.
And this mm-hmm. poses enormous challenges for nation states. Like you've got the whole the nomadic worker class now. All sorts of things are changing at the at the individual level, and how do we deal with them at the nation state level? How do you do taxation, for example, etc.?
And this sort of fraying, like, you know, one of the things that is like, you know, there's this open air drug market in I think Philadelphia, maybe.
Okay.
They've just written off a neighborhood as being like what amounts to an open air heroin market.
Okay.
And you know, the video footage of people just wandering around there with cameras is like, you know, I mean, it's the sort of thing that, like, it's in the 1970s, it's full Mad Max, right? It's just, oh my God. And it's basically, they've just decided that's where the problem is going to live, and that's where the problem lives.
Right.
And your desperate addicts will go from long distances who wind up living in that neighborhood. Oh my God. It's just terrifying, right? And at the same time as that is happening, you know, you've got sort of the endless scrimmage in, you know, San Francisco about whether you're allowed to build anything higher than two stories.
Hmm.
You know, and that's within the same nation state. You have abject horror of a kind that you associate with the collapse of the state, at the same time as you've got NIMBYism gone wild, resulting in house prices being four times what they need to be.
Yeah.
I don't think the systems of government that we have are able to handle that much longer.
Hmm.
And what comes after the systems that we currently have, you know, I just feel like the existing equilibrium that we're in is now paper thin. I think COVID was in some ways like the last straw in the existing game.
Yeah.
And I think it will take one more systemic shock before we see pretty large scale social reorganization of the kind that you're seeing in the UK around things like Brexit. You know, what's happening with Brexit is a little bit like what happened to Cuba when the Soviet Union collapsed. Only we sort of did this ourselves. The running joke in the UK is, you know, we collapsed early to avoid the rush.
Right.
but we can no longer support, you know, the post-World War II cheap energy, massive Western dominance, massive American dominance. 1970, American factory workers were paid the equivalent of $65 an hour.
Yeah.
In modern money, might have been 75. People that worked on lathes were making the same kind of income that programmers were making in the tech boom. And America produced something like 25% of the world's industrial output. You know, all the standard of living expectations and the scaling of the critical infrastructure and social infrastructure that were built in the post-war boom, now unsupportable.
I'm going to highlight a little fascinating little negative cycle that we came across. There's a fellow called Robert Goldberg, who's one of our community members, and he's a VC gone into private equity, and he's created a whole paradigm called reinventing American exceptionalism.
Oh, I've heard of that. Yes.
And what he's done, he takes the EXO model and he applies it to traditional mid-market industrial American heartland companies. Mm-hmm. And what he found out when he started doing this was that these companies have all lost innovation, and they thought that the blame was globalization, that all the jobs have been shipped overseas. Well, it turns out it's not the case. It turns out the problem is private equity has gone and bought these companies, hollowed out the cost structure so that you don't have any extra money, no fat to expend on innovation. Mm-hmm. And then the way to cut costs is to globalize that, right? And the incredible last piece of the sting in the tail of this is that the PE firms are funded by LPs, who are the California pension plans. So the pensions of the workers are going to fund the PE funds because they want stable returns that then go to globalize and outsource their own jobs. And you're like, wow. And so we're actually collaborating on a book to highlight all this and bring this to the fore, because the misalignment of incentives is perverse enough to kind of screw this up in a huge way.
Right? Yes, absolutely. So, absolutely. And the pension funds are like countries. I mean, they've got the power to make policy that shapes the world, for sure.
Massive, right? So, all right. Vinay, we're running out of time. And
amazing.
This has been a fascinating conversation. Thank you for taking us through this. We will post a link to this resilience map and the presentation in the podcast. Any last words before we wrap it up?
So there is, I have some old workshop videos of people using this system to do things like estimate the social resilience of entire countries. So if anybody's interested in getting hold of that material, drop me a message, and I'll send you some links.
Great. Why don't we get those links from you, and we'll post it into the description so people can track it down
themselves. Yeah,
that would be wonderful. And then we'll get contact information from you that we can let people get a hold of you. All right?
Fabulous. Great.
All right. Folks, this has been the Salimist Smile podcast, where we talk about all things transformation. Our guest today has been Vinay Gupta, part 3, and we'll probably need a part 4 to talk about some of the more interesting things that came up right at the end. But it was really important to get through the kind of the specifics of what do we mean by systemic risk. And I think Vinay's done one of the best jobs of that we've seen out in the world. So thank you for being with us. We'll call this the end of the podcast. Everybody have a great day, and follow us at the links below. Talk soon.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
All right. I am so excited to announce the launch of our new OpenEXO platform. It's a game changer for those of us who are passionate about building a better future through the breakthroughs of new technology, plus new mechanisms for exponential organizations. First things first, the platform is home to the amazing Exponential Organizations 2.0 book, a living book, which means it's constantly updated with the latest case studies and the greatest breakthroughs in technology. ChatGPT, for example, is incorporated into the book already. With a basic membership of just $4 a month, you have access to all of the resources, 700 plus case studies. If you're not satisfied, you can cancel anytime. And it actually features a job board to help you connect with like-minded individuals, plus an AI-curated news feed that's head and shoulders above everybody else. So why not join today? Be part of a community that's working together to build a future. And for those of us who are ready to go full throttle, our premium membership offers even more perks. You'll have access to the courses and masterminds, communities of experts and thought leaders who are changing the game and building exponential organizations to transform the world. So what are you waiting for? Join us today and let's build a future together.